Our main topic is negotiation, especially for couples.
Actually, I'd like to talk about a different topic, if that's okay with you.
Well, I'd rather talk about the one we agreed to, Pete.
Actually, I just had a brainstorm idea, and I think that if we go in and if we can just talk about the combination of money and sex today, that could be better than talking about negotiation.
Well, dear, if that's what you'd like to do, I'm all for it, and I will listen to you.
If all negotiation was just that simple, oh my goodness. Why do people get hung up on negotiation? What kind of things can be negotiated and what kinds of things cannot be negotiated? And just knowing that can save you a lot of stress in your relationship.
In fact, in marriage, there really are a number of things that can't be negotiated and that people confuse with things that can be.
And boy, is that a prescription for trouble when you try to negotiate something that does not lend itself to being negotiated. And I hope we get into some what some of those things are, Ellen, down the road.
We definitely will, Pete.
Oh, that's good.
You know, as we were thinking about this call, I was just reflecting on the week I'd spent with couples and thinking about some of the issues that had come up and realized that some issues that I'd heard a lot this week were issues about can we agree on how much TV time to give our kids, or they're always in front of the TV and never doing their homework, and especially since this is the time of year when school is starting, a lot of couples are facing the need to negotiate on issues about who, simple things even like who's driving the kids where, who's, how much time they get to spend in activities, how much time on the computer, how much
who's going to fill out all the paperwork that the schools send home, which is just reams and reams of paperwork, which I came to appreciate watching you do all those reams of paperwork when Molly was in school.
Absolutely. And certainly, again, I heard a lot of things this week on money issues. Are we going to set a budget? Can we agree on how much money we're going to be spending on things like remodeling and redecorating? So these are just some of the issues that came about in my practice this week.
And it grows from there. As soon as you think about all the different roles and responsibilities that couples have around the house, not just the couples, but for the kids. What are the responsibilities of the kids, and where do they fit in terms of doing chores, participating in making the house run a little more smoother and a little bit more equitably? A lot of negotiation goes around chores and different roles and responsibilities. So, Ellen, that's a backdrop. Negotiation. Is it more complex than you tell me what you want, I tell you what I want, and then we see if we can find a win-win solution that works for both of us? We brainstorm ideas and then select one that wins for both of us. Isn't that what negotiation is?
I'm sorry, Pete. I think it's a little more complicated than that, but there is good news. The good news is that many of our listeners have heard us lay the foundation with some of the skills that we've taught and that we'll be mentioning again today. So negotiation is actually based on a number of skills built on top of each other.
Man, I tell you, if you happen to be working with your partner, like Ellen and I do, so we not only have all the typical things around the household, roles, responsibility, chores, etc., but we also have all the opportunities for having to negotiate when having a business together, the Couples Institute. And boy, if that doesn't set the stage for an almost infinite number of possibilities to negotiate on who's going to do what according to what standard and when is it going to get done by.
So, Pete, I think maybe a good way to get into this might be to talk about why learning to negotiate makes sense, and also possibly looking at some of the mistakes that people make before we actually get into the skills on what to do.
Well, actually, making mistakes is, here's kind of a subset of that, which is a big part of negotiation means that you have to manage tricky emotions. You also have, when you negotiate something, there will inevitably be, if the negotiation problem is very complex, there is very likely to be a collision of values, a collision of interests, a collision of concerns, a collision of different feelings. And these factors do not lend themselves to an easy list of negotiation steps. Go ahead.
Well, in fact, one thing about the emotions is that recognizing that you are usually negotiating things that have an emotional component to them is crucial, because if you just only treat a negotiation like you're dealing with logistics, partners are in danger of running over each other.
And sometimes what looks like might be a just kind of a straightforward negotiation, like the other day I went to the movie with Ellen and Molly, our daughter, and they wanted to see Julia and Julie. I go, you read the reviews, there's not going to be one single explosion in the entire movie, it looks like to me. But we talk about going to it. We all ended up going to it, and it turned out to be actually a kind of a cute movie in spite of the lack of explosions and gunfire. So you can negotiate with stuff that looks like it shouldn't have a lot of emotion to it. However, a lot of things end up do having emotion. So
let's talk for a minute about some of the most common mistakes that people make when they get into thinking about negotiating or they start negotiating.
Good.
And one of those is often folks surrender their own interests too quickly. As a desire to avoid tension or to keep the peace, and as a result will cave in way too fast.
And high conflict avoidant people will do this a lot. They will just smile and wave when a difficult negotiation comes up.
And that leads me to another piece, which is if you misinterpret the rub. In other words, when you're negotiating, if you know that you two don't agree on something, there's going to be a clash point. There's going to be a tension point. And that recognizing what the tension point is a very effective part of negotiation. But if people use that, like I said, to surrender too quickly, or they're afraid of feeling the tension that comes with that clash point, they'll misinterpret that as something bad, rather than as, hey, this is where our negotiation needs to begin. Another downside or mistake that many people make is stubbornly pushing too hard for their own solution. And if you're putting way too much energy into persuading your partner, then it usually will mean that you're fixed. You're fixed in pushing your own desires. You're wanting your own desires to predominate. And in that energetic process of trying to persuade your partner, you're not even thinking about what does Pete really desire? What does he really want? Because I'd be thinking too hard about my own desires and pushing them.
Unless it's movies, and then you have a pretty good idea.
And a willingness to push for them at times.
Yeah.
And the last thing is failing to prepare adequately if you know that you're going to be negotiating something with your partner. And I liked something that Lee Steinberg said, and he was a negotiator for a lot of the big NFL football players, including Steve Young. And he said, the biggest mistake even the highly trained negotiators make is that they don't put in enough prep time. And that means thinking ahead of time, planning ahead of time, trying to recognize each person's interests ahead of time, and also not being willing to be silent, not being able to be silent in the middle of the negotiation to let yourself digest what's going on.
Now, this is pretty interesting. Because it does take time as you keep moving through the process to reflect on what your partner is wanting, what they don't want, and why, and start to ask questions about it. Now, here's what's interesting, the adjustment that Ellen and I had to make really quick on today's call. We had a couple who were we had lined up, and we were going to give the background to negotiation like we're doing right now, and then walk them through the steps of actually negotiating a struggle that they were having. Unfortunately, they had to drop out at the last minute. So,
like 10 to 5 yesterday afternoon.
And so Ellen and I we'll just continue to do what we're doing now, is describe the steps for what's required to make an effective negotiation. And then we have also sent out the handout so you can follow this at home or use the handy sheet the next time that you and your partner have to negotiate something. But getting a more elaborate commentary on the steps, I think, can help you go through the steps on the sheet more smoothly and easier. So, we have, here are the common mistakes. Cave in too quick, you push too hard for your own solution, and you don't prepare ahead of time. What we think, actually, it makes so much difference. If ever there was a statement that of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, it is worth it in preparing for the negotiation. So you think to yourself, if you have a pretty good relationship, do you really need to negotiate anyway? Why do you have to learn this? If you have a good relationship and you're both kind of pleasant, accommodating to the other person, why do you need to learn these skills? Well, here are some basic concepts.
The first one is that, in fact, learning to negotiate will actually push growth in yourself and in your marriage. And a relationship that's not growing, that's not evolving, where people in it aren't changing, becomes stagnant. So even though the negotiation can be challenging, it's an avenue for a lot of personal growth.
Yeah, conflict is inevitable. If you're alive, you're interested, you're engaged, you're doing things, conflict is going to be inevitable with your partner. So you have to learn the negotiation steps because of that. Plus, a lot of people are frightened of conflict because they can't negotiate, so they avoid conflict, they avoid disagreement, they avoid bringing up things that they think might disturb their partner. Because once it's out there, they don't believe they have the skills or the desire to really negotiate. So if you learn these skills, then you don't have to be so afraid of disagreements or conflict.
In fact, good negotiation will lead to solutions. It's kind of trite. You always hear about win-win, but it will lead to solutions that work for both of you. And also in that process, strengthen your relationship.
And your communication skills will automatically improve as you develop good negotiation skills. They go hand in hand. Your communication skills will improve. So what does everybody always strive for when they negotiate? They say, yeah, okay, let's do win-win. Sounds good. However, these are the best, absolutely, but they are often difficult to attain. Why is that? They require some self-knowledge, plus a really high degree of understanding your partners, their values, their concerns, their desires. And you have to have respect for yourself and your partner. You have to be open. You have to persist. And this is what makes the negotiation process successful.
It's also true that each time you have a successful negotiation, it's going to lead to more trust between the two of you. It's going to help each of you feel like, oh yeah, I can count on him or I can count on her to be accountable. And therefore, it's always laying a foundation for better future outcomes.
Actually, negotiation too is very often it's an ongoing process and not a one-time event. And I think too often people believe, well, we should be able to sit down and hash this through in a one-time discussion. The reality is, the more complex the situation is, the higher the stakes are, or the more that your core values are involved, the longer this is going to take, and you're not going to be able to do it in just one or two discussions. The more complex the problem, probably the more trial and error solutions that you will need to attempt. Now, here's the key thing. People believe if we have a successful negotiation, we will end up with a really perfect solution. The reality is there is no such thing as a perfect solution, because every solution sets the stage for another problem.
Or at least another discussion.
At least. And this is because the challenge you have solved by negotiating this will open the door to another set of challenges that you wouldn't have attempted without doing a successful negotiation before. So there is no such thing as a perfect solution.
Let's talk for a minute, though, Pete, about one big difference when couples are negotiating than when business partners are negotiating, or even somebody is negotiating a sports contract or a real estate deal. And a big difference is that the amount of self-disclosure. Partners want each other to self-disclose. They want to know, why is that important to you? What does it mean to you? And it actually takes, to get to good outcomes, takes more openness, more curiosity, and definitely a lot more emotional risk.
Absolutely. And it's that amount of self-disclosure, that really personal, deep self-disclosure, which is essential for complex negotiation in couples, is something that generally is avoided in almost all business negotiations. It's a huge, huge distinction.
Pete, before we go into some of the skills, we now have a couple people on the phone as well as some people listening online, and I just want to, for anybody who's on the phone, if you've got questions, comments, we'd welcome your participation. Please feel free to jump in. And
Can the people online type in a question? Is that possible?
If they're on the right page, they can. But
comments, reflections, or questions so far would be good.
Anybody online, anybody on the phone have any questions or comments?
Not so far.
Okay.
I don't know.
We're glad you're with us.
Maybe you guys will get into this into the phone call, but what would you say to the couple who says, you know, I listen to what my partner says, and we end up fighting, and now I have a new problem, now we're in a fight, and we just can't get through.
Michelle, I tell you, that's a common reaction, and
yeah.
It's a common reaction because they haven't done their homework, and they haven't really practiced the skills that we're going to cover,
okay.
And maybe they're even trying to negotiate something that cannot be negotiated. So what are these skills, Ellen?
Well, let's touch on some of them briefly, but then we're going to go into a little more depth. I mean, and some of this sounds trite, but it definitely takes good listening skills to be able to negotiate.
What do you mean by good listening skills?
It means that you'll put a cork in it and you'll listen. You won't butt in.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say, so let's just keep moving on, shall we?
And, you know, sometimes you want to be listening for what's underneath that's even more pushing your partner than they even recognize. So sometimes when, both people are open to learning about themselves, the more open they are to learning about themselves, then the more able they are to bring out into the open the desires that are pushing this particular negotiation.
Well, you have to be open about expressing, too. And it may be expressing a lot of things that feel quite vulnerable to express. And at that point, the partner really needs to listen carefully and respect that kind of vulnerability. One of the ways of doing that is simply just recapping what you're hearing. Powerful, powerful aspect of listening. So what I hear you saying, honey, is dot, dot, dot. Is that right? And then say, well, that makes sense. I can understand why you would say that because dot, dot, dot. And then the other person really feels like they're being heard. It's safer to open up and go even deeper into those things that really will set the foundation for a better win-win solution.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Sure.
Yep. I sometimes would like to invent a device whereby my room sprinkler system was linked to some kind of a temperature probe attached to my clients. so that when things got to a certain heat, you know, the sprinklers would come on, everybody would cool down, which is kind of, you know.
I like it.
Which is kind of my way of saying that like, you know, in the super negotiation article, they talk about, you know, managing tricky emotions are part of negotiation. And the problem here is that you know, all the ideas you're presenting really make a whole lot of sense to me, but people get so incapacitated to use them when they get upset. And so there's that constant people just getting too upset to use the skill sets they may even have under better conditions. And I know this is a really common problem, but I'm just wondering how you build that into the whole negotiation process where people can...
It's a good question, and it happens a lot. And it happens because somebody will get triggered, and
mm-hmm.
they will have some emotional memory that's triggered, some emotional pain that gets triggered.
Right.
And when they get triggered, they start to feel flooded. The partner can help a lot if they can remember to do, all right, I will listen carefully. I'll recap what I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I won't ask leading questions like, well, did it ever occur to you that, ...
Mm-hmm.
So doing the recapping, taking a deep breath, literally stretching to leave the tension in your body,
mm-hmm.
will start to help calm down physiologically. It's the tension in our body that we're trying to get relief from, but it comes out in terms of defensiveness. The being genuinely curious, what do you mean by, can you tell me more about, can you say why that is important to you?
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen and the partner recognizes that you're listening with genuine curiosity, the emotional temperature goes down.
Mm-hmm.
So they can begin to regulate that kind of intensity themselves. But sometimes, you know, sometimes you need a third party to help remind them to do that.
Yeah.
A couple of things that I like to do when I'm working with couples who have, you know, issues that they're likely to get triggered on is, first of all, to talk about something that Kohut said that I love. And he said, the mark of a really great marriage is when only one person goes crazy at a time.
Uh-huh.
And I tell that to everybody that I work with because, you know, it's, the expectation is not always that both people be 100% calm.
Mm-hmm.
But if one of you can stay, keep yourself together and ask those questions or do the recapping when the other one is triggered, you can then begin to bring the emotional temperature back down.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that a very helpful concept.
I think, too, that we're afraid, you know, if we really take time to understand what our partner's saying and ask questions, that now that I'm understanding it, then that means I agree with it and need to make a change, and that's not necessarily the case. Those are two different things.
I'm glad you brought that up because it's a huge, huge misconception that so many people have. If I really understand what they want at the deepest level, then how could I possibly refuse giving it to them? How could I possibly refuse not responding to what they want? And so the psychological antidote is we just don't ask questions to understand. It's a way of protecting ourselves from that possibility.
Right.
If we go back, when we talk about skills required for negotiating, and I just will add another chunk here, is preparing ahead of time to negotiate, which is to think about where both people begin to think about how do I aspire to be in this process with my partner, and you begin to think about the qualities or traits that this is how I want to be in this negotiation with my partner. You might say to yourself, all right, I really want to be calm. I need to be open. I need to be flexible in listening. I need to be honest with my partner with compassion. I need to be curious. I need to be understanding. And if you actually reflect ahead of time about how you want to be, write those qualities or traits out on a piece of paper. Put them in front of you so that when things start to heat up, as sometimes they do, look at your paper, take a relaxing breath, and go, oh, yeah, I need to be understanding. I need to be calm here. If you get into that space following your own guidelines, you will short circuit so much of the tension and short circuit so many of the arguments that we were just talking about. That happens a lot of times that couples get into a fight is because mostly they're not following their own guidelines for how they aspire to be in this discussion.
I always wish that people that I'm talking to or working with would also realize that each time they do something, like Pete's talking about, for example, writing down the guidelines and staying consistent with those, each time they do it, there's a higher likelihood that they will be able to do it the next time, and that they really are developing new capacities in themselves, and that those capacities will help them be very, very effective as partners.
You know, the other overlooked concept is when you're negotiating and your partner's doing well, give them a compliment. Honey, I really appreciate how calm, how open, how vulnerable you're being, how honest you're being. I really appreciate that. That makes it easier for me to do the same. It makes me want to be kinder, gentler, more open with you. And so give each other compliments along the way. Don't forget that. It's a way of continuing that good process.
Let's talk a minute, too, Pete, about what can and can't be negotiated. Because, you know, basically negotiations work best when you're negotiating behavior or you're negotiating decisions. And, you know, this is things like what somebody will do, what somebody won't do, when you'll do it, what role you'll take.
And what standard will they do it by?
Right.
So who will do what by when and according to what standard? That is, in a nutshell, these things are the only things that you can never negotiate, is the behavior. Who will do what by when and according to what standard? However, couples try to open it up.
Well, you can also negotiate decisions like, you know, where are we going to live, or are we going to remodel the house, or are we going to cut that tree down, or whatever. But in negotiating decisions, those decisions that have the most far-reaching impact in both people's lives are the ones that are going to have the most emotional base to them and the most emotional concerns, and are the ones that are the most dangerous when people barrel over top of each other and don't arrive at a solution that works for both partners.
So what kind of things cannot be negotiated?
I would say you can't negotiate values.
Well, actually, you know, there's another way of looking at this. These things not only can't be negotiated, but if you think about it from the perspective, these are things I'm not willing to compromise on, because negotiation often involves some degree of compromise. Here are some things people are unwilling to compromise on.
Or it may not even be so much compromise as much as it's experienced as, this is who I am, and if I surrender who I am in a very total way, like I give up a total value system, an example would be parents where one parent thinks spanking is okay and the other parent doesn't think spanking is okay. Or when somebody asks another person to give up their religion, just don't feel like they're able to do that.
So you can't negotiate like, okay, I'll give up my religion if you spank the kids. So you can't negotiate core values and spirituality. You can't negotiate your integrity, that if you go down a certain path, you say, no, that's not who I am. If I do that, it'll compromise my integrity. And you can't really negotiate emotions either. I'll do this if you feel better. Well, they may or may not feel better. They may or may not feel affectionate. So you can't negotiate desire and emotions. And you can't negotiate trust either. Trust is earned. You can't negotiate it. People have to do things to earn the trust. So you can't really negotiate attitudes, how you treat me. You can't negotiate respect. Respect is earned. I will do X and maybe respect will follow.
And let's talk a little bit about the emotions and the attitudes that people have that might interfere with effective negotiation, or even some behaviors that people might do that interfere with effective negotiation. And I want to start with my one that I put a giant exclamation point beside, which is if you start to denigrate your partner's desires as those desires are expressed, that is a giant no-no in my book, because once you start to denigrate your partner's desires, your partner will likely go underground. But that doesn't mean that you're not going to get the sting, the bite, the passive-aggressive behavior, the fight back later in some way, plus the problem will not be solved in a good way for either of you.
So an example of that, Ellen, is would it be something like the partner brings something up and then I might say that's not going to work, or we've
more like, God, what a stupid thing. Why do you want that?
Mm-hmm.
Are you kidding? That's what you want? Are you serious? You really want that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that kind of, you know, or belittling it in some way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Also, all of us have, you know, beliefs and attitudes that we got growing up as kids. And some of those beliefs and attitudes can interfere with our ability to be effective negotiators. So, for example, I grew up in a family where I was not supposed to want something unless my sister wanted it. And so it used to be hard for me to say, okay, here's something I want, even if it was something Pete didn't want, because I was only allowed to want something that somebody significant in my world also wanted.
On the other hand, that seems to have some advantages.
For you. Definitely. People can feel like they don't deserve it, that they're not worthy. If you believe that your partner or the significant people in your life will never care about what you want, then it's hard for you to engage fully in a negotiation process. On the other side, sometimes people have beliefs that will make them into bullies. So you believe the only way to get what I want is to fight for it. I'm not going to let anybody push me around. I'll show you who's boss. Then you may end up using those beliefs and attitudes to fuel a very aggressive stance in a negotiation.
Yeah, it's just you just keep your focus on what you want, and it's so hard to include your partner's perspective. So here's the thing.
Let's just pause again for just any comments, questions, whatever.
Yeah,
too.
I had a question. You know, when do you find the best timing is for making observations of the kind that if you were to observe a dynamic or an interlocking dynamic between two people where different family of origin issues cause them to, you know, to hook the other person into these problematic behaviors, do you sometimes do this ahead of time as a preliminary, or do you tend to do more like process commentary while you're helping a negotiation go through? Because you at times I imagine you see these things emerging and they're really undermining the whole negotiation process.
Well, see, there's actually two responses to that. One is if you have a third person who's helping a couple negotiate, you can deal with this in real time as they come up.
Mm-hmm.
If a couple is working on it on their own and they don't have somebody to help slow it down and reflect on, oh, wait a minute, what is being triggered in you right now? You know, what where is that coming from? What conclusion did you make from that earlier life experience that seems to be showing up right now with your partner? So if a person doesn't have, I mean, if a couple doesn't have that kind of immediate, real-time input, then they're going to have to do more preparation work on their own. So they might think about things that would interfere with me being a good negotiator with my partner. And so those are the questions that would be useful to reflect on. For example, under we have fears that interfere with a good negotiation. Somebody might be afraid of a reprisal if they're assertive with their partner.
Mm-hmm.
So if I speak up, they're afraid their partner is just going to come after them or they're going to trigger. They don't want to offend their partner.
Well, also, A rule of thumb that I kind of use when I'm, let's say I'm sitting with a couple and they've said, okay, we want to negotiate where we're going to spend Thanksgiving this year. I'm making something up right now. And I do a lot of preparatory work with them before they start the negotiation and define their roles and what they're going to do. And then if I see some of what you're talking about, but they're actually continuing to be able to move the negotiation forward, I will keep supporting the things that move the negotiation forward and stroke them and, you know, define some of the things that I see that they're each doing that are positive.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a later time bring up, here's some things that I noticed that I think may endanger you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Or may get in the way. If the old things that are being triggered become too pervasive and they're interfering or they're leading them to veer off track or not move forward, then that might be a good time to raise them.
Yeah, and see, there's also kind of a fear that if I really speak up, if I really enter this with goodwill, with a positive attitude, good intentions, and it doesn't work out, it may trigger some historic fear stored in the emotional brain, which is, you know what, I never really get what I want. And that just discourages further negotiation down the road because it triggers some of these old memories. The interesting thing is, what I find is couples often try to negotiate too big of a chunk of a problem to start with, and that right there creates huge problems. They'll say, all right, we need to talk about how to discipline the kids. And that's really too big of a chunk to negotiate. It has to be broken down to start with into a bite-sized chunk, like how are we going to discipline Junior when he starts being oppositional, rebellious, and mouthy, as opposed to when Junior's doing something else. So it really needs to be broken down into a small chunk to begin with. That makes the negotiation process a whole lot more targeted and often a lot smoother and easier. Couples often say, okay, we need to negotiate the budget. No, it's too big. How about negotiating one item in the budget, like how much are we going to spend on eating out, instead of trying to tackle the whole budget as a global thing. So breaking it down is an enormous help to a smaller chunk.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we've mentioned this before, but the preparation. So before I have a couple that are sitting in my office start a negotiation, I want them to reflect on a number of questions, and I want them actually to have a problem statement that they bring up. But some of the questions I want them to reflect on are, first of all, what is the issue? What is it that I want us to negotiate?
It's broken down into some bite-sized chunk.
Absolutely. What is the outcome that I desire? What's the outcome I imagine that my partner is desiring? How important is it to me, and why is it important to me? I want them to really be thinking about, you know, on a 1 to 10 scale, is this something that's a 10, or is it a small nuisance and still something that we disagree on, but it's not way up there at the top of the list?
Being able to label that for your partner takes a lot of tension out of the potentially, so that everything isn't negotiated like it's a 10 or an 8.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because a lot of times the intensity that people put in it to it will make it all seem like it's that high, way up there.
Especially if there's a lot of emotion behind it, but the problem itself seems kind of small. But if there's a lot of emotion, then what it symbolizes is probably really big. So a person thinks as part of their reflection, if I get most of what I want, what will be the positive? And what would be the negative effect on my partner? And how could I make it easier for my partner to say yes to me?
Getting a good answer to that question means a lot of awareness of who your partner is.
You betcha. And so why would it be difficult for my partner to give me most of what I want? How could I increase the benefits to my partner if I get what I want? How could I make it easier for them to say yes? So they really have to start thinking about not only what they want, but they have to start thinking about the importance of the partner. And that preparation then automatically starts to include both people. And it can begin to reduce some of the tension that you were talking about earlier, avoiding some of the fights, because they escalate too quickly to the solution. Well, you want this, I can't give you that, you're just being an idiot for asking this much, and then it deteriorates.
And a lot of times I like to ask them to write some of that down before they start talking to each other, especially if I know it's on a really, really charged topic.
Now, here's one of the very key things. When they start discussing the problem,
the best statement to start with is, "We seem to disagree about," and then fill in the blanks.
Yeah, instead of saying the problem is, as soon as you say the problem is, honey, it's almost impossible to avoid pointing a finger at your partner or yourself. You know, like, all right, we got to talk about discipline. Well, the problem is, honey, that you're too strict. No, the problem is you're too easy. Oh, let's talk about the budget. Well, the problem is you spend too much. No, the problem is you're too tight. You can't really define a problem without pointing a finger.
Well, in fact, once you define it that way, it means one person is defining the problem.
And one person is going to be wrong. If you come, and this is hard often, to get to the place where you can say, we seem to disagree about, you could say, we seem to disagree about the consequences when Junior is mouthy to us. We seem to disagree about how much money to spend on going out to eat. We seem to disagree about the budget that we're going to allocate for redoing the kitchen.
A couple that I saw just earlier this week came in with all this, you know, initial tension in the session about it's the beginning of school and there's too much going on and we're fighting a lot and we're disagreeing a lot. And when I actually pared through some of it, they were having a very significant disagreement about when to hold a memorial service for a grandparent who had died. And there was an enormous amount of emotional tension that was being generated by their inability to resolve the situation about where and when to hold the memorial service.
Now, it often takes a lot of trial and error to come up with the statement that you can both agree on, which is, we seem to disagree about. But putting it in that form that you both can agree with saves a huge amount of problems down the road. So, okay, then what? You said, okay, we have agreed. This is what we've agreed to disagree about. Now, what happens next is, now that you've got that out of the way, one person goes first, and they express all the concerns they have about that topic, like, all right, you're too strict in disciplining. Here are my concerns. I'm afraid that if the punishment is this strict, I'm afraid this will be the consequences on our child. And so you talk about the concerns. You say, look, I've either read this, I've experienced this in my own life. I am afraid that we could turn our child into da-da-da if we discipline our child in this way. So you talk about your concerns. You talk about where these concerns come from, how important these concerns are. And the partner is listening, recapping, asking questions, getting an elaboration on what the concerns are, so that each person has a chance to fully explain what their concerns are. And this is a really crucial part to do this, so that know that your partner understands your perspective.
Yeah, and ideally you would have each person saying, yes, I believe that you understand my concerns. So the concerns have been put out in a full enough picture that each partner can say, okay, at least I feel like you listened. I feel like you understood what my concerns are. At that point, you can then move to brainstorming possible solutions. But one of the things that I think Pete and I do that may be different than a typical brainstorming situation is I ask the partners, to, when they're brainstorming, to come up with, for example, if Peter and Jane are having a disagreement, I would say, Peter, I'd like you to propose a solution that you believe could work for Jane. And Jane, I'd like you to propose a solution that you could believe could work for Peter. And then I say, in fact, you can put it out like this. Here's a suggestion that I have, and I believe this suggestion would work for you because of, and that would include some of the concerns that had been expressed, and it could also work for me because.
It meets your concerns. This way, the person who is brainstorming the solution has to avoid the two big problems that we talked about earlier. It keeps them from pushing too hard for their own position because they have to take into consideration their partner. It also prevents them from caving in too quickly because they have to identify something that works for themselves.
I was recently working with a couple who were having a big problem. They had moved into a new house not too long ago, and there was a giant old oak tree right outside the kitchen window, and it was creating nothing but darkness in the kitchen. And she was saying, I really want to cut this tree down. We moved to this house so that I could have the experience of light. I even get depressed in the winter when things are dark. I need the light. And he was an environmentalist. He'd spent his whole life protecting the environment. He could not, under any circumstances, tolerate the idea of cutting down the big tree. And when they began to, and they really thought they were just at a complete impasse, and when they began to propose solutions, at first he said, well, I'll make a suggestion to prune the tree. And if we prune the tree, that will create some light, a little bit of light for you. And it will work for me because we won't have to tear the whole tree down. And they went back and forth a number of times. And then at one point, she actually came up with a proposal, and she said,
let's move.
Well, that was thrown in there at a couple points. But at one point, she finally said, I just thought of something that I never thought of before, which is, how about if we put a really big skylight in the kitchen? And then that would work for me because I would have all the light, and that would work for you because you wouldn't have to cut the tree down.
But see, here's an interesting thing about that. As they do so with a collaborative, cooperative, curious attitude, our brain will start opening up to other possibilities because we're not under a threat. And that's what helps create even better solutions. And that's a really great example of that. So let's say somebody proposes a solution. The partner said, yeah, okay, that works for me. And then you got to add, then they add, and here's why. Here's why it works, yeah. And it works for you, I'm glad. If the first solution proposed doesn't hit a bullseye, then the partner says, all right, the part that does work for me in your proposal is dot, 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 and the part that doesn't work is dot, dot, dot. And so then the counter proposal, again, is offered with, here's my alternative suggestion. Here's what works for me. Here's why it could work for you. And it's keeping that focus on works for me, works for you, that keeps it moving along without that horrible stuck place, finger-pointing negativity.
There's something amazingly relieving, too, about hearing your partner propose solutions that might work for you instead of having to come up with all of those yourself.
And each person keeps adding value to the offer. They keep finding ways to make it easier for the partner to say yes. Now, remember, you're not looking for a perfect solution. This negotiation, these steps, they're an experiment. Think about it like an experiment, and nobody is going to be locked into a permanent solution. If it's possible, you say, we're going to try this for a period of time to see if anything needs adjusting after doing this. And that's the key, is that you don't feel like you have to have a permanent perfect solution in this negotiation. Look at it as an experiment. The negotiation is going to lead to an experimental approach to see what happens, to see what really needs adjusting after we apply it. And then you take action and you decide who's going to do what by when. And then you evaluate it. You come back. If it needs to be renegotiated, redefined, then you start again with, here are my concerns, here are your concerns. Let's repeat them again. What did we learn? What did we discover? Okay, here's a counterproposal now, given that what we have learned. Here's what I think might work. It could work for me, and it could work for you because dot, dot, dot. And you can, sometimes you need to just keep coming back to that approach. You try it, you experiment, you see what happens, you learn something, and you bring it back again. If it's done with goodwill and good faith, couples can negotiate some really thorny stuff without getting into some of these nasty collisions that just make them avoid talking about it in the first place.
So let's open it up again for a minute, Pete, to comments, questions, reflections.
Because I'm going to have to wind down in a minute.
Definitely.
I had a quick question.
Yeah.
It had to do with this business about how you state agreements, you know, we seem to disagree about. But some of the problem I've experienced is that if people slip, you know, evaluative language into there, like, you know, the good or bad, or the way you discipline is bad, you know, it this derails things real quickly. And I was trying to listen to you in terms of what phrasing you would use where, you know, you might try to discuss outcomes that would be a course of a particular source of action. So it gets more around results than around evaluations, because
it's a good point. I'm glad you brought it up, but I don't look so much for outcomes as much as the process.
Mm-hmm.
We seem to disagree about what church or what religion to raise our kids. We seem to disagree about how much to spend on. We seem to disagree about bedtime, so that you're not trying to even build in an outcome as much as define what we disagree about the process.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and I think that, again, a big part of the process is doing what you can, using your best instincts and skills to help people be collaborative in the process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can almost give me any problem, and I'm getting, because I've done it so many times with so many couples, I get pretty fluent and fluid about helping them quickly identify what they seem to disagree about. But that only came after a lot of practice.
Right, and I know you're very skilled at that now, dear.
Except that sometimes when I'm in the middle of it for myself, I seem to lose that skill that I have for other people because I'm more personally involved, which tends to bias me just a little bit.
Well, anytime I'll be glad to tell you what we disagree about.
Terrific.
So I think we do need to wind down for today and just